Chapter 3. Peterson Air Force Base, Colorado Springs.
Good morning, Admiral. Welcome back from Saudi.
Thanks, Petty Officer Nathan. It's good to be home. Snow mountains and no more sand fleas. The young petty officer stood at her desk when he entered, her uniform perfect and posture ramrod straight. She had coffee prepared every day by 5:30 a.m. The drip had just finished.
The morning brief is ready when you are, sir.
In a minute. I'd like some private time.
Yes, sir.
The Admiral passed through the Executive Assistant's office into his own and closed the door. Behind him, the daily activity of Northern Command, or NORTHCOM, shifted into high gear. Watch standers spent the night mining data from around the world and gathering intelligence assessments to prepare their bosses for the decisions of the coming day. The day shift presented the material and developed the responses. Petty Officer Nathan was one cog in this massive machine called Homeland Defense. Near the top of that chain sat Rear Admiral Victor Hayes, the NORTHCOM Director of Operations. Inside his office, Rear Admiral Hayes pondered a strange sense of foreboding. He couldn't explain it, but something was very wrong. He stared out the expansive window at the snow-covered slopes of Pike's Peak to the west and the single light at the top of the rugged mountain. Sunrise was in full swing, and the snow took on a pastel hue as the rays painted it pink, red, and orange. Within an hour, the snow would be blinding white. He imagined the new workday beginning deep within the impenetrable snow-capped Cheyenne Mountain, south of Pike's Peak, as Strategic Command watchstanders soon would change shifts at 0600 hours. Today's new crew would consume terabytes of data from satellite surveillance systems, ship radars, ground cameras, and the super-cooled optic eyes of the Defense Support Program, each sensor combining to give them the eye on any missile launch around the globe. He knew the rigors of their often tedious job, defending against a possible missile salvo and nuclear holocaust. A job for which surveillance of space junk was also a critical part of their mission, preventing potential ultra-high-speed impacts that could disable critical national space intelligence systems, the shuttle orbiter, or the International Space Station. All the operational capabilities of the United States military were at his disposal. He could reach the President, the Secretary of Defense, even the NATO Secretary General from his phone if he wanted to. Yet all the power of his position could not quell the uneasiness that gnawed at him. Turning from the window, the Admiral sat on the corner of his desk and thumbed through a well-worn leather-bound Bible, not searching for any particular passage, but open for insights. Then he heard a plane. He looked up abruptly. A flash on the side of Cheyenne Mountain, to the left of Pike's Peak, illuminated the pre-dawn murk. As he strained to see where the explosion had occurred, a second fireball erupted. It was the Cheyenne Mountain entrance, he was sure. Rear Admiral Hayes was reaching for his red phone, the classified direct line to the operations center in the hardened core of the building, when a Cessna 185 flew by low, much too low, headed toward the high-security antenna farm adjacent to NORTHCOM. Those antennas were his eyes and ears and his command link for the defense of the country. He was momentarily frozen. Then his training kicked in as he screamed for Petty Officer Nathan, picked up the red phone, and threw the Bible on his desk. He'd only spoken half a word into the receiver when a thunderous clap slammed him violently from the back. Glass shards sliced the air like hundreds of razor-sharp shotgun pellets. Pierced with glass, a blast wave flung him across 20 feet of red carpet into the flinching body of Petty Officer Nathan in the doorway. Intense heat melted their polyester uniforms and charred their flesh. The Admiral's face slammed into the door jamb. Furniture, books, and a storm of glass flew around them as they careened through the doorway. The lifeless Admiral and Petty Officer and a massive walnut desk caught a surprised Navy captain squarely in the back, crushing them all through the next wall toward the center of the building. The anti-terrorist blast protection for the exterior of the complex was insufficient to contain the power of this explosion. Northcom lay ripped open. After two successive aircraft bombs, a ragged, smoking gash lined with twisted girders and shredded concrete led from demolished outer walls to the hardened core of Northcom, the operations center, the only part of the building that remained unbreached. But not for long. Minutes later, a massive detonation raised even that hardened core. A tall, green Air Force pumper truck, the first to arrive and park adjacent to Northcom, erupted along with 10,000 kilograms of embedded explosives. The cleverly disguised fire truck weapon pulverized the headquarters for America's homeland defense. Northcom and the brains of America's space surveillance system collapsed in a pall of dust, concrete, and twisted girders. South of Coal Creek, Colorado. As the telemetry links from each aircraft fell silent, Nick silently tallied the impacts, his lips moving slightly. He knew that the watch floor at Cheyenne Mountain would be pandemonium by now. His little gift wouldn't slow down operations, but it would have obliterated the command's primary entrance. The huge blast doors would be sealed under a temporary wall of rocky rubble. Nick smiled as he remembered the narrow emergency tunnel, now the crew's only access. It would be days, perhaps weeks, before the operational capability of the mountain's watch teams was fully restored. A tiny smile played at the corner of his mouth. Nick and his crew watched the satellite transmissions as telemetry links failed when flights drove their deadly payloads into satellite ground control sites, antenna farms, and mission control buildings at Peterson Air Force Base to the northeast. Inside of 3 minutes, the aircraft destroyed the entire ground control infrastructure of the National Network of Infrared Space Sensors, along with key offices of the Northern Command headquarters.
All 7 primary targets are destroyed. The mountain and Northcom are blind, for now.
What about the mobile missile defense control vans overseas? Nick asked.
Verified that they were out of commission an hour ago. Just like you planned, Tex replied as he manipulated the controls for an aircraft on final approach to its target.
Beautiful, Nick said, setting the empty macadamia nut can aside to make an entry in a notebook that he carried in his back pocket.
Place the call, Tex, and continue to the secondary targets.
Tex nodded and hit speaker on a phone to his left. He dialed, and the line rang once, then answered.
Status? Asked a cultured feminine voice.
All clear. You have a window of 24 to 36 hours, Nick said as he crossed his arms. No more than that. I'll keep you informed.
Very well.
The line went dead.
Video imagery from each attacking plane provided a bird's-eye view as each craft struck its target.
This is a rush, Billy said as his own aircraft homed in on its target.
Front row seat, Nick said. Enjoy it.
As a group, the men watched the terrorist aircraft fly to within centimeters of their designated impact points. Billy's aircraft flew through the yawning glass mouth of Air Force Space Command, a block west of the decimated Northcom. The camera continued to transmit interior images of the office complex as the wings ripped free, spewing a cloud of gasoline throughout the modern alcove. The explosive payload in the fuselage careened through the center of the glass and metal structure. With no interior walls to cushion the blast, 300 kilos of high explosives eviscerated the facility moments after the gasoline ignited. Like the Twin Towers 10 years earlier, the top of the shiny modern building came crashing in upon itself. It would never reopen.
The last two aircraft flew north to Buckley Air National Guard Base near Denver, where they hammered home into space antenna farms and a fortified building. Inside of 10 minutes, Nick and his crew rained 1.5 metric tons of high explosive on the Northern Colorado Military Space Complex, snuffing out the eyes and ears of the nation's space surveillance and missile defense. Back east, it was a typical morning commute. 8 a.m., March 21, 2011. Traffic snarled in the wet Monday morning weather. One by one, 30 light aircraft on legal, pre-filed instrument flight plans transited the metropolitan Washington, D.C. airspace from every compass point. Once cleared by the FAA through the terminal radar area, the planes dropped out of sight, descending to treetop level at 30 pre-planned waypoints to foil radar and anti-aircraft defenses. Fighter aircraft, notified by desperate FAA controllers, scrambled too late from nearby Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. The military had disbanded its combat air patrols over Washington a year earlier, citing the lack of credible intelligence on airborne terrorist threats against the Capitol. In truth, their cancellation was a cost-saving measure. Nick's deadly darts sliced through America's air defenses. Three aircraft were lined up on filed instrument approaches to Ronald Reagan National Airport, while another 8 screamed downriver, skimming above the Potomac and its bridges. 8 more came upriver from Mount Vernon, and another 6 flew at low altitude off the wooded banks of the Maryland side of the Potomac. 5 penetrated from the north down the Anacostia River. Covertly placed Army air defense systems went into full alert, but they were overwhelmed by the multiple threats skimming low above the water and trees. Even if they had been ready for this onslaught, the hidden missiles could not home in on such low-altitude targets. The first Washington telemetry link failed at 0805. This was the lead bird, a twin-engine aircraft on a flight plan to a landing at Ronald Reagan National Airport at 8:07 a.m. Just as it was supposed to bank right abreast the Lincoln Memorial, the aircraft dove left and low over the ellipse. Moments before impact at the White House, a shoulder-fired Stinger missile dispatched the attacking Beechcraft twin-engine Baron and its monster 500-kilogram warhead, raining a hailstorm of fiery debris on the Rose Garden. The explosion shattered all the windows on the exposed face of the White House, raining glass on the presidential staff and hurling President Manchester and his staffers into the curved walls of the Oval Office. They were being whisked, too late, from a meeting to the hardened basement of the mansion following notification of a possible attack. The second aircraft on approach to Reagan Airport deviated to the right. Before the National Capital Region Emergency Response System could react to the White House attack. With only a slight change of course, the twin-engine aircraft plummeted into the heart of the Pentagon. Perfectly timed, the airplane detonated moments before impact, setting off a shockwave 5 meters above the ground within the inner courtyard of the Pentagon, affectionately known to its workers as Ground Zero. The 500-kilogram blast sent jagged glass shards ripping through the A-ring of the world's largest office building, at the height of commuter activity, killing hundreds. 3 minutes later, a second twin-engine bomb found the same mark. The inner ring of the Pentagon disintegrated as Nick's team drove 2 successive stakes into the soft underbelly of America's military power. Air defense artillery picked off a few flights from the north as they tried to come in low over the Anacostia and turn west into the city. 2 crippled craft and 1,000 kilograms of high explosive fell on the low-income neighborhoods northeast of Washington, D.C. in a hail of burning gasoline and exploding ordnance. Tower controllers at Reagan Airport saw an aircraft approaching low from the south. Just before it decapitated the control center in a single fiery explosion. Another plane coming down river above the Potomac was narrowly missed by air defense artillery and bored in on the Reagan Airport concourse, flying through the tall glass walls at the city end of the terminal. A different weapon load, 300 kilos of jellied gasoline, sprayed flaming hell on hundreds of passengers and employees. Few were able to escape as glass and flames erupted out of the disintegrating crystal terminal along its entire length. Elsewhere around the district, the Bethesda Naval Hospital and the Vice President's residence at the Naval Observatory were each destroyed by surprise attacks. The National Security Agency north of Washington was also a target, but the attacking aircraft was shot down on its approach to the ultra-secret facility. In only 5 minutes, 30 aircraft and 10,000 kilograms of explosive terror overwhelmed the world's center of democratic government. Washington ceased to function. In their mobile command post in southern Colorado, Nick switched his attention from the telemetry monitors to CNN and Fox News broadcasts, which began to capture the devastation in the first moments after the attack. "How long?" asked Tex, anxious to execute the next phase of their operation. "Wait till traffic's deadlocked. Where's that report?" Nick paced slowly behind his men and their computers. Tex nodded and selected a speaker for a live TV helicopter transmission from Washington. He also selected webcams of traffic at critical nodes throughout the capital. Emergency vehicles tried in vain to reach Washington from Virginia and Maryland. The district's streets were gridlocked by escaping motorists and fires from planes shot down over the city.
Traffic snarled.
"Make it happen."
Nick licked his lips. Less than 5 seconds later, Texas remote command ignited charges planted on the pylons of every bridge in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area. Near Dahlgren, Virginia, the towering Route 301 bridge, weakened at two critical pylons, collapsed in the center and plummeted 100 meters to the Potomac River below. 200 metric tons of concrete and steel pressed dozens of motorists forever into the bottom of the broad waterway. In quick succession, the George Washington, Memorial, 14th Street, Key, Roosevelt Island, and Chain Bridge structures all collapsed at their centers. Hundreds of cars were demolished as they plummeted into the rivers, the drivers trapped in frigid, murky water, unable to escape through inoperative electric windows. Each of the Anacostia River bridges plunged into the polluted northern tributary. The center of the new Woodrow Wilson Bridge near Alexandria disappeared into the Potomac, severing the last artery to Maryland. Near McLean, Virginia, a gasoline delivery truck barely missed diving over the edge of the pavement when the Cabin John Bridge disappeared on Interstate 495. As the driver struggled to stop the rig, it was gored and upended on the bridge's concrete side rails. The driver had no time to react when the punctured diesel tanks spewed fuel on hot brakes and set the entire rig ablaze. Traffic helicopters captured the graphic event on video, showing the truck swerve and turn the southbound lanes of I-495 into an unquenchable inferno. The Metro and Amtrak river crossings were detonated near their centers, severing the last possible link into the city from the south and east, and blocking any future river traffic. The Yellow Line Metro, headed from the Pentagon to downtown, jolted as the bridge heaved in the middle, then tumbled and fell 20 meters into the Potomac. Many of the riders woke from a commuter nap to a neck-snapping impact as the train plunged headlong into the river. Television cameras on a traffic helicopter captured the sickening image as the Potomac swallowed the Metro. Nick raised his arms in a two-armed weightlifter cheer, fists clenched. He slapped Tex on the back, intoxicated with the remarkable success of his complex operation. The grisly horror on the news channels fanned his passion in this moment of triumph and revenge. He made another note in his pocket notebook, then placed a second call on the speakerphone. "Phase two complete," he said when the erudite woman answered.
"Very well. Continue,"
was the only response, followed by the purr of a dial tone.
"Pack it up. We're done here," Nick ordered. "On the road in 15 minutes.
3 minutes ahead of schedule, the Colorado team was gone, headed in two different directions. As the RV pulled out with Nick at the wheel, he turned toward the back of the van and issued his final order of the attack.
"Tex?"
"Yeah, Nick."
"It's time. Light up the others."
"Just waiting for your word,"
Tex said as he hit the enter button on his keyboard. A Red Cross blood van was parked in front of Washington's beautifully restored Union Station terminal, a strategic area to seek donations from commuters. Tex's command ignited the explosive-laden van and destroyed the only remaining transportation hub in the district. 10,000 kilograms of fuel oil and fertilizer emasculated the historic structure. Decades of history collapsing upon hundreds of travelers. Outside Washington, a Dulles airport bus, which had been parked at the baggage level all morning, disintegrated in another 10,000-kilogram explosion. It took half of the terminal with it, bringing the swooping new addition crashing down on the baggage handling level. The explosion decapitated the Northern Virginia Air Terminal and crushed the capital's last ability to function effectively as a transportation hub. With both airports gone and no routes open across any river, Washington was cut off from the nation. 1,000 kilometers to the south, Texas signal ignited the most potent weapon of all. A small version of Hiroshima raised a commercial space propulsion research facility in Huntsville, Alabama. Multiple trailer bombs identical to the Nevada test obliterated a rocket research industrial park in a series of blasts and secondary fires that leveled every building within a quarter-mile radius. More than 200 employees in the secret rocket development plant died in the blink of an eye. A half hour after the first aircraft impact in Colorado, the nation looked over its shoulder expecting more carnage. But none came. The attack was complete. Thank you for joining us in this sampler of scenes from the upcoming release of The Evidence. You can learn more about Austin Boyd, his writing, and his ministry at www.austinboyd.com. A Navy pilot, nuclear weapons officer, and spacecraft engineer, Austin Boyd flew 3,000 hours in war and peacetime operations, designed satellites, and built classified systems to track terrorists. A world traveler, NASA astronaut finalist, and inventor with multiple patents, he served in key Navy space assignments before retiring to Huntsville, Alabama, where he lives with Cindy, his wife of 28 years, and their 4 children. He continues to support NASA, military space, and aviation through his work with a major defense contractor. An active Christian, Boyd has served in a variety of lay ministries devoted to evangelism, stewardship, and crisis pregnancy. In addition to writing the Mars Hill classified series, Boyd has also penned dozens of technical articles about space issues and has written award-winning poetry. Thank you for your interest in Austin Boyd's writing and our newest release, The Evidence.